All right. Welcome, everyone. My name is Scott Shepherd, the founder and host of the City's First podcast. We are really excited here today to kick off. I believe this is the 18th episode of the City's First podcast in our third year of production, season three. And with that, one of our most esteemed and notable guests that we've had so far in our kind of 2 year history is Veronica Vanderpool, the acting administrator of the Federal Transit Administration in the United States. So, Veronica, welcome. We're really happy to have you here and kind of share insights.
Thank you so much, Scott. I am delighted to be with you on the City's First podcast.
Thank you, Veronica. So, as our listeners and subscribers well know, our format, it's pretty a short form. It's usually about 35, 40 minutes. We'll kick it off with a brief intro, which you're doing right now. We'll go through the guest's bio, and then we'll kick it off with a few questions. I think we have about five questions here, which are really interesting. Then we'll round it out with a little bit of kind of a look ahead and a conclusion. So with that, again, just a little brief bio for Veronica. So she is the FTA's acting administrator, assuming that role on February 24th, 2024. Before that, she has served as deputy administrator since May 2022. She first joined FTA as senior advisor in August 2021. As acting administrator, Ms. Vanderpool helps advance the goals of the Biden-Harris administration related to equity, climate, innovation, safety, and workforce development. She oversees policy priorities and objectives along with day-to-day operations of the 700-person agency. Having served on a number of boards, commissions, task force, and working groups, Ms. Vanderpool has 17 years of experience in advocacy, policy, media, communications, public outreach, coalition building, and issue campaigns. She is co-founder and former president of WTS Delaware, a member of Latinos in Transit, and a 2023 awardee of the COMTO headquarters, Women Who Moves the Nation. She was also finally selected to join the first cohort of the Biden administration's presidential leadership workshop. So with that, and that is the abbreviated bio. So just for everyone to know, it was actually four times longer than that. So I think with that, we'll get started here. But thanks, Veronica. So with that, let's kick it off with the first question. This is kind of a conversational open format. I'll just kind of sit back and let you take the mic. I might add in a few thoughts. But with that, our first question for you or topic is, tell us how FTA delivers equity in public transit. And with each question, we got about 6 minutes, Veronica, just so you know.
Sounds good. Thank you, Scott. So the Federal Transit Administration invests in communities across America. We want to improve America's communities through public transportation. Whenever we are investing in ferries, buses, subways, trolleys, van pools, we are investing in mobility and equity for individuals who are low income, individuals who are living with disabilities, people of color, older adults, students. So we are advancing equity through the very nature of our work in ensuring that people are connected to what matters to them. That is education, that is housing, that is health services and recreation. And again, most importantly, connecting people to each other. Under President Biden, and because of the passage of the bipartisan infrastructure law, there has been a tremendous focus in this administration on equity. In fact, the president initiated Justice 40, which is a presidential order that requires at least 40% of benefits from grants and programs and initiatives of the federal government flow to disadvantaged communities. And last year, 63% of FTA's, one of our most competitive grants for low and no emission technology and buses and bus facilities met that Justice 40 standard. So what does that look like in a given community? So I want to provide an example of what Justice 40 looks like and how the Federal Transit Administration administers Justice 40. So in Charleston, South Carolina, FTA granted the local transit authority there about $26 million to buy battery electric buses and build a regional transit hub for its fleet. What's important about that is communities near the transit center are areas of persistent poverty, with 87% of community residents being people of color and 56% of those residents being low income. So we are advancing equity by ensuring that this community has clean, available, convenient, reliable public transportation to get around. Another way FTA has invested in equity and advances equity is through the use of minority and women-owned businesses. So last fiscal year, FTA awarded just over $1 billion through our Disadvantaged Business Enterprise Program. So that was over 4,000 FTA-funded contracts. And that's about 14% of all of our contracts. And what's important to know is with the bipartisan infrastructure law, which is the biggest investment in transportation in a generation, there's so much money on the ground and in our communities. And it's important that we are sharing this wealth with firms and contractors and businesses, many of which have not had the opportunity to win some of these federal contracts before. We're giving them an opportunity with our sheer focus on disadvantaged business enterprises. And they're now being able to serve as prime contractors or subcontractors. And when you combine that, it's over 4,000 DBEs in this space. One big rule and update is we updated our DBE regulations just last week, making it easier to be certified and to remain certified. And that sends an important message. And then one final thing I want to say about equity is we think about equity really holistically. And we think about the areas of our country that are not well served by public transit. And FTA provides a lot of funding to transit systems and metropolitan planning organizations and state departments of transportation so that they can invest in public transit systems in their communities. But we also support a lot of research. So we spent $6 million with the University of Minnesota to study transit deserts. And many of us know those are areas that are isolated from transit. And what the research has indicated is that many transit deserts are in communities that are Black or Brown. And what's important about this study is we have to measure and better understand what these transit deserts are, how they're created, how to reverse them. And when the study comes out next year, we'll be able to see where access is lacking and then correct for the inequities of public transportation and the transportation network broadly in this country.
I love what you mentioned about the transit deserts. Yeah, because I'm very eager to see the results of that study. Thank you for sharing that as well as all the other examples around DBE and kind of covering the entire value chain in a very holistic approach, Veronica, but certainly around transit deserts and ameliorating and fixing the poor policy choices of the last century in the United States and in many other developed countries as well too, related to urban planning, public transit, et cetera. So it's really correcting a lot of the mistakes of the 20th century and kind of finding and moving forward and using stimulus and government federal funding, as well as partnerships at the local and regional level to kind of affect those policy goals. So I'm very heartened to hear that.
Thank you, Scott. And I appreciate you noting all the important levels of engagement at all levels of government. You noted local, state, certainly federal. It is a partnership that is required to make these investments and changes.
Yeah, that's the only way things can get done. So absolutely. Not in isolation. All right. So our next question is quite related to the first one, but a little bit of a spinoff, which is how can we make public transit more accessible to all users? Kind of broad, and it's whatever interpretation you want to share with the audience.
Whenever there's an investment in making transit convenient and reliable and affordable and safe, we are making public transit more accessible because we want individuals to come to transit for all of those reasons, because it is a mobility option that serves them differently than other modes of transportation do. But there's some specific ways that we have been investing in accessibility of our system. So we are renovating rail stations across the nation to comply with the Americans with Disabilities Act, which many of us know was passed in 1990. But today, there's about 900 stations. They're known as legacy stations that were actually built before the law's passage in 1990 that actually are out of compliance with the Americans with Disability Act. And in 2020, 25% of American rail stations were inaccessible. That means that individuals who are using a wheelchair, individuals who are using some other mobility device, someone with a cast, an individual pushing a stroller, it is very difficult for them to access those rail stations easily and conveniently. And sometimes it impacts the use of that particular station because an individual decides to go out of his or her way to use maybe a more accessible station with an elevator or an escalator than use a more convenient station for them because it is not accessible. So what FTA has done is set aside $1.75 billion to make these stations more accessible, again, to start whittling down the 900 existing legacy stations that are out of compliance. Last year, we awarded about $686 million for 15 projects. And we'd spend, this is the city's first podcast. So I want to talk about one of the largest cities with transit, the largest transportation network in the country, and that's the New York Metropolitan Transportation Authority. I actually had the privilege many years ago of serving as a board member on New York's MTA board, and they received $254 million from the FTA to make three stations in Brooklyn and one in the Bronx, my home borough, fully accessible. And what this means is that this funding is going to this to New York MTA for things like installing elevators and updating platforms so the gap between the train and the platform is not as big, or even adding platform edge warning strips, modifying fare gates so they're wide enough for, again, a wheelchair or another mobility device to pass through, and even improving handrails. And these are, again, significant enhancements. I don't want to say amenities, because what we want to move towards is a future where all of these become standard parts of our rail stations. But right now, as I've noted, they're not. I also want to talk about a recent visit I paid to Claymont, Delaware. I actually lived in Delaware for a little while. And FTA invested $51.7 million to help build a completely new transit hub. So for both bus and rail, that for the first time in the 33-year history of mobility and transit in that particular city in Delaware, Claymont, will finally be accessible to people with disabilities. And again, we understand the importance of making sure that people can access their local transit option. It is a game changer for so many people in that community. And they're getting new elevators, for example. And that's not just a convenience. That's a necessity for many.
Segue. My thoughts on that are that it's not an amenity. It's not a convenience. These are necessities. It's part of the standard, let's say, offer of any kind of multimodal hub. And it really kind of addresses this gap in terms of accessibility, equity, and serving to kind of, let's say, basically induce a sustainable modal shift too, and make public transit really the option of choice for all Americans, and addressing this gap in these train stations that perhaps have the deficiencies and are not in compliance with the ADA. So those were my thoughts, and I apologize everyone for the pause, but we're back on air here. So unless you had some other thoughts on that topic, Veronica.
I think it's important that we continue to note that accessibility is both the physical infrastructure that we're investing in, but also the service expansions, right, that many transit systems are investing in. And FTA also supports that in many ways through both our formula dollars and then our competitive grants. And physical infrastructure is a big deal, particularly with the bipartisan infrastructure law. But I did just want to take just a few of those seconds just to note that how we expand service and how transit systems provide service is also part of that accessibility.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. So let's go on to our third question, which is around innovation. So what are some of the latest innovations that can bring riders back to public transit, at least to what we've seen during the pandemic, kind of the decline, the recovery, and making this kind of, let's say, a ridership recovery wedded to innovation and wedded to, let's say, new service offerings, sustainable and permanent, so that this is not just kind of a temporary recovery period.
The Federal Transit Administration, we like to say that we're innovation investors. And I think that may sound weird to many people who are not used to hearing about federal government being an investor in innovation. But the way that we do that is by providing funding to transit systems and other grantees, again, departments of transportation and metropolitan planning organizations, to reduce the risk as they pilot new technologies and they pilot new ideas. And one way that we've done that and supported that innovation that has helped bring riders back to service is with on-demand transit and microtransit systems. And in fact, I have direct experience with this. So before coming to FTA, I was working in Delaware for the Delaware Transit Corporation. And one of the projects that I launched, in fact, with funding from Federal Transit Administration, it was an interesting foreshadowing of my work down the road, was launching an on-demand microtransit system in a rural part of the state. And the transit agency worked with a third-party provider and used its own transit vehicles to reduce wait times for a population of individuals who were mostly low income, who were Spanish speaking, who many were immigrants. This was an agricultural rural community in southern Delaware. And while transit was being provided by the transit agency in the state, it was not as frequent as we know people need. Buses were coming anywhere between 60 to 75 minutes. And that was certainly a challenge for individuals who were relying on public transportation, but couldn't use it to get back and forth just because of the amount of time that they were waiting. And because of the launch of this pilot service, transit wait times were reduced to 15 minutes or less. So that meant it afforded new opportunities for people to get to work, to then maybe run an errand on their lunch shift and then make it back to work, all using public transportation, all without using a personal vehicle or a loaned vehicle. And some of the most frequented destinations from this rural transit service using this new technology was, you know, the local big box store and a social service agency and the manufacturing plants, which were the larger employers down there for poultry. So, it was eye-opening to see how significant this change was to people's mobility, and ridership grew significantly. I want to provide another quick example about bus riders in a small city in rural North Carolina called Wilson. And a very similar situation. Wilson bus riders did have access to transit service, but the buses didn't come very often. And fixed route service provided by the local transit system only served about 40% of the city. And that was a real challenge for many of the residents. Many of Wilson's residents live below the poverty line. In fact, 1 in 4 people in Wilson live below the poverty line. And about 12% of residents did not have access to a car. So FTA provided the funding so Wilson could launch this on-demand microtransit service. And today, that ridership triples what the previous fixed route service was. So when we provide the funding to reduce the risk in many cases for innovative approaches, sometimes using technology, as in these two cases in Delaware and North Carolina, where they were able to work with a third party software provider to add this technology into their systems. It's made a tremendous difference in people's everyday lives. And those are the stories that we like to talk about. It's not just the big dollar amounts that are impressive. It is the time savings and the mobility that we give to individuals. That's incredibly impressive too.
Yeah, it's innovation across the value chain. And it's really kind of focused on these use cases that are addressing gaps in ridership, transit deserts, getting back to the Minnesota study you talked about. I think it's related to that. I think the examples of microtransit and on-demand are really great in these context-specific areas. I think you'd probably agree with me, though, not to push back or challenge, but I don't think we want on-demand or microtransit to replace fixed route and kind of heavily performing areas, but we need to be kind of context-sensitive and say that it boosts and increases overall ridership in areas where there's opportunities for growth in underserved communities, kind of in, let's say, rural or suburban districts with very kind of low density land use and all that stuff. But it's more of a comment and a question. But what do you think about that, Veronica? Do you have some thoughts in terms of taking more of a surgical approach to on-demand and combining that with fixed route?
The most successful pilots that we've seen that have moved from the pilot to the permanent stages have been those that have complemented and often relied on fixed route service. That was certainly what I personally saw during my time in Delaware. Again, it was the agency's existing transit vehicles and their operators. And what they did was just kind of modified service that was being provided in a different way and found deficiencies in that way. And we've seen that work, that model has worked best for the longevity of these sorts of pilots into permanent offerings to transit riders and communities. And I think fixed route service is incredibly important. And when it's complemented by some other ways of moving people around, whether that is an on-demand microtransit service, or whether it's partnering on bike share, or whether it's complementing investments in bicycle and pedestrian infrastructure so people can safely get to transit stations and bus stops and train hubs, et cetera. So we want to make sure that we are investing in integrated approaches that both sustain the viability of the existing transit network and system, but are also introducing people to other forms of getting around and other ways of getting around. So in short, Scott, I hear you and we agree.
Yeah. And it's a toolkit approach, really. It's like there's not a one size fits all for every community. And like you mentioned, bike share, or, you know, other forms of shared and active mobility, and mobility as a service, whether it's an app or physical infrastructure, and promoting this kind of new thinking that's multimodal and moving, breaking down the silos. So I love to hear that. And I know DRT or on-demand and microtransit are one of many, let's say, measures that FTA and local operators can use to kind of achieve these policy goals. So it's really great. And I appreciate you kind of giving us those two examples.
Okay. And Scott, if I may just quickly add another, I know this is a city's first podcast, but I know when you talk about cities, you're speaking expansively, even about not just our cities such as New York and Philadelphia and Chicago and Boston, but cities across all of America. And yes. I was just in Cincinnati this week, and we were celebrating and looking at upcoming proposals and ideas for the city's future bus rapid transit lines. And the technology that the city of Cincinnati, particularly with the transit system there, Metro, you know, they're introducing all sorts of technology to improve the bus riding experience for thousands of people who rely on their corridors every single day. And it is important because we were on corridors where in some neighborhoods, 40% of households do not have access to a vehicle. And the investments that they're making with bus rapid transit is, again, a future game changer for so many of those individuals who rely on or those who are choosing public transit in cities of all sizes across the U.S.?
Yeah, as an urban planner, it is a game changer. It's actually a very modest investment for regenerating these communities that were decimated by poor policy choices in the 20th century. And it's really helping to rejuvenate American communities through the work of FTA. And kind of, you know, your example in Cincinnati speaks volumes to kind of that approach in terms of really trying to kind of push these initiatives forward. So yeah, that's another wonderful example. So our fourth topic or question is back to the infrastructure bill 2022-2021. So a little bit more specifically, so how has FTA leveraged the infrastructure bill to, quote, Secretary Buttigieg, to build back better? you can respond however you want to building back better.
Absolutely. Well, with this historic investment, and I can't say this enough, we say so much about this being a historic investment in transportation and unprecedented transit support in a generation. This is $100 billion in transit over a five-year period. That's the largest funding of public transportation in America's history. But it's really a down payment on the transportation needs ahead. And so when we think about building back better, we're thinking about using this, again, this $108 billion as a down payment for all the investments that are still yet to come. And we are at a crossroads in this country. I loved sharing this stat. I think it's so incredibly impressive. And since the bipartisan infrastructure law was passed just a little over 2 years ago, the Federal Transit Administration has awarded $65 billion in formula and competitive grants to about 9,000 transit projects nationwide. That means there's nearly 9,000 transit projects in our communities all across America that are seeing this money, that are making changes in people's lives, that are making it easier for people to connect to all the things, again, that we've noted that are important to people's everyday and their livelihoods. That is a significant, again, down payment on building back better. But there are some key ways that we are making these investments now for the future. So we are making the biggest investments in low and no emission buses on our roadways. So many of us know that the United States, 27% of greenhouse gas emissions comes from the transportation sector, but the transit sector is a very small sliver of that pie. We contribute about less than 1% of greenhouse gas emissions, but there's always room for improvement. And FTA is advancing that improvement through our investment in this technology, again, for low and no emission buses. So this is hybrid buses, hydrogen buses, battery electric buses. And we have awarded $4.8 billion in grants for almost 3,000 low or no emission buses, including nearly 1,800 electric buses. So we are not just saying we want to invest in public transportation, which is a climate mitigating goal, but we want to make sure that the investments we make are incorporating the greenest and the cleanest technology so that the transit vehicles operating throughout our communities are the cleanest, greenest. So that is one key example of how we are building back better. We're soon actually going to announce another round of these grants worth $1.5 billion. And we're in this open application period now where transit systems and others have until April 25th to get their proposals to us for consideration. It's interesting because one Chicago bus project estimates that it will take 8,000 tons of CO2 out of the air within a historically neglected neighborhood. So when we talk about building back better, we're also talking about supporting communities' goals to build back better. And we're key investors in that goal. We're key investors, again, in communities and in Americans. We also have another program called the Rail Vehicle Replacement Program. And that is to add 500 new rail cars that have been on the rails perhaps longer than they should be. The importance of that is that it improves safety of that rail transit system. It improves reliabilities. And it also supports the American economy because these are new American-made rail cars. So we're making these grants in cities like Chicago, Philadelphia, Baltimore, to replace about 300 of these new vehicles. So again, thinking about building back better, right? We're looking at assets, transit assets, that are past what's called a useful life and ready to be retired is basically what that says. And making investments for more generations to come. I want to talk very quickly about ferry service because most Americans don't use ferry service, but in many communities, ferries are a critical mode of transportation. In fact, I had the opportunity to travel to Alaska, and Alaska doesn't have the most interconnected roadway and highway infrastructure. It's interspersed with many islands and many waterways, and they rely on ferries to get around, in addition to public transportation such as buses. But we have made investments of over $400 million in grants for ferry systems over the last 2 years in places such as Alaska to support the Alaska Marine Highway, for example. And many of these services are supporting remote communities, which are many of which are tribal or they're Alaska Native communities. These ferries in some of these areas are more than 50 years old. So when, again, the replacement of some of this old, these older assets sustain this service and serve as an inducement and enticement for people to use transit because they see that their trips are becoming more reliable. They are becoming safer because of the new technology. So we're glad to share some of those examples about how we have been investing and building back better.
It is a down payment on the future. Thank you, Veronica. And yeah, it sets an example for the entire country to see what's the opportunities and the possibilities ahead for using public transit, whether it be waterborne or ground transit, and how Americans can really travel in the future, maybe outside of their automobile. So again, it's all about sustainable modal shift, and it's about setting an example at the federal level to actually lay the groundwork for local and regional agencies and private operators to help take the ball and run with it. I mean, that's what we hope. And that's, I think, what this is. And it's a once in a lifetime or certainly once in a generation opportunity here. Something I've never seen. Yeah, and it's on the scale that, you know, the Interstate Highway Act, you know, in the 1950s and the Eisenhower administration. So it's unprecedented. But with that, we thank you, Veronica. We are running out of time here and I don't want to cut this off. I did have time for a final question, but we would run out of time. So I really appreciate your time here today and your contributions. It's been an absolute honor. And just want to let our audience know that this episode will be published shortly on Spotify, Google, Amazon, as well as Apple and other channels. And Veronica, maybe just 30 seconds, some final parting words in terms of, you know, what's the path ahead?
Well, Scott, thank you so much for exposing your audience to the great work of the Federal Transit Administration. I don't think many people really understand the role. And I'll confess, I've come from the advocacy community before joining this federal government job. And I have such a stronger appreciation for the work of Federal Transit Administration in communities across the United States. So thank you for giving us an opportunity to share what we do and how, again, we improve America's communities through public transportation.
Absolutely. As an urban planner and on the City's First podcast, we're huge believers in the role of public transit in America and worldwide. And again, it's about fixing a lot of these choices in the 20th century and providing a better, safer, more equitable, accessible, sustainable future. So with that, thank you, Veronica. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Scott. I appreciate being on this and joining you for this discussion.